You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Rick Britton is a Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer. An award-winning historian, Rick also organizes history-related lecture classes in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Thursday, October 6, 2011, Meg Kennedy presented the fourth lecture in a continuing series entitled Virginia History 201, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, A Dynasty of Friends. Research coordinator for the Manson Interior Initiative at James Madison's Montpelier, Kennedy talks about Dolly Madison's early life as a Quaker, her tragic family losses to the dreaded yellow fever, her marriage to James Madison, a principal framer of the Constitution, and her wonderful and welcoming influence over the White House in the early days of the Republic. This is part 4 of 5. Here's Meg Kennedy.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Dan. Thank you, Rick, for the very warm welcome. I have actually had the tofu platter at the Barbecue Exchange, and I will say it is quite good. So if there are vegetarians among us, it could be worse. So I want to thank everyone for having me tonight. This is a wonderful opportunity, and I'm excited about the series that you've been listening to and placing Dolly Madison in the context of this neighborhood of friends in the greater area, I think is very exciting, and I'm glad to come talk to you a little bit about that. And when Rick and I were first talking about the series, I made a flippant comment about, well, this will be the light talk, the fun and easygoing talk. I was thinking about Dolly's love of French furnishings and good wine. But the more I started to put this together and thought about her in the context of the rest of her life, I take back that comment that she had an easy and light life. She actually is a very complex and dynamic character, and I will never more make such a flippant comment about Dolly's legacy. So those of you who've lived in the area for a while or who've been following the Madison story may know about the restoration that's happening at Montpelier. So about 10 years ago, if you went to visit, there was an enormous pink stucco house, DuPont house, estate, and horse tracks all in the front. And today, if you come, you'll see a Madison-era home. So they spent the last 10 years doing a restoration effort to take away these, I think about 30 rooms to the mansion, to find underneath the Madison's home, restored to their retirement era, which we date about 1817 to the 1830s, when Dolly and James came back from Washington and spent their final years in Orange County. And if you have come to visit and you've seen this smaller house, what you also saw was not much else. There aren't furnishings in that. Many furnishings in the house. It's empty at this point. I work on a project that Rick just mentioned, the Mansion Interiors Project, where we are trying to fill back up the house as it looked during the Madison's retirement. And those of you who visited Monticello and Ashlawn and, of course, Mount Vernon know that people have been collecting the furnishings of these founding fathers for 2 centuries now. And unfortunately, at Montpelier, we have just begun that process. And Madison items, objects, are around the world. They're spread across the country. We just found a set of Madison porcelain china in Hawaii, owned by descendants of the family. We are slowly trying to bring back what we can But a lot of these objects are in private collections, or they've been on display in museums for over 100 years. So my group is working to research everything we can to know what it was like to visit the Madisons, to come to their house, to experience Montpelier in this retirement phase, 1817 to 1836. We're doing this specifically through a documentary project where we have been collecting copies of any known Madison correspondence, any letter, bill, diary account that is either from the Madisons themselves or written about a trip to Montpelier or a visit with the Madisons in Washington, trying to find the moment where they describe the chair President Madison was sitting in or the food that they ate at the table so we can more accurately reflect the Madisons at Montpelier. This has been an enormous undertaking. We're a grant-funded project, and we're doing all this, I should say, with a database, a FileMaker database, at which I can talk about for quite a long time. I spend most of my day in front of a database as a historian, which is not what I thought would happen. But I'll spare everyone the details of that. But if you're interested in database design, I'd be happy to talk at length about that. When I closed the database yesterday, we had about just over 29,200 documents in the database that we've collected that somehow deal with the Madisons during this era of their lives, which is an enormous amount of material. Not all of these letters or diaries are in and of themselves solving the case of furnishing this house, but they build together to give us clues. And we're in the process of analyzing the documents through a series of keywording and indexing. And what we have found very frustrating is that, like many women in her era, Dolly instructed her correspondents to burn her letters up after reading them. And we now know that this was the case for many women of her generation, that they wrote just as frequently as men, but that their letters were typically destroyed because they weren't considered necessary for public perusal, especially after their deaths. So for Dolly, we do not have day books. We don't have recipe books. We don't have her instructions to her domestic servants, to the enslaved community at Montpelier, which we do for President Madison, who instructed overseers on how to maintain the agricultural fields. But unfortunately, we do not have a lot in Dolly's own voice that talks about how she ran her house, how she wanted the space. So we hold very firm to the few clues we do have. But what we also have learned through the extant letter, there are actually a number of extant Dolly letters because she was famous in her own time. She was very well known. People saved her letters. And even some that have the instructions, please burn or destroy after reading. And what we can make of those letters is really understanding who she was as a person. It's not necessarily facilitating our effort to recapture her furnishings, but we're learning more and more about her every day. And we actually just this week found three new visitors we never knew had been to Montpelier. We're tracking anyone who came from, of course, Jefferson and Monroe and their families, to the slaves who came with them, to the merchants who dropped off purchases, and then seeking their papers, trying to find the clue when they wrote home to say, I've been at President Madison's house, and here's what I'm experiencing. So I want to give you a little background on Dolly also. Her birth name, Dolly Payne, comes from a family just north of Richmond area, in today what is Glen Allen area, a Quaker family. Her mother was a Coles family member. Dolly herself was born in 1768 in a Quaker community in North Carolina near Greensboro area. Her parents had moved there to be part of a Quaker settlement where of planters and farmers, but didn't stay long and moved right back to Virginia when Dolly was a toddler. So she spent most of her childhood in Virginia. Her father, like most people in this area, was a tobacco wheat planter and struggled with the issue of slavery. He owned slaves as a Quaker and was called to manumit his slaves, but was reluctant to do so in Virginia because of the laws that, this is a better topic for Beth Taylor, someone else who knows about the subject better, but my understanding is that the laws in Virginia said that freed slaves could be recaptured and by, say that again?
After 12 months.
Yeah, after 12 months, okay. Up until 1780s when the law changed. And at that point, Dolly's father manumitted his slaves, knowing that they would be protected by the law in Virginia, and moved the family to Philadelphia, which was, of course, the capital at that time, one of the most prosperous cities, metropolitan cities in America, and took a position as a merchant, which unfortunately did not suit him well. It didn't end well, and they were in economic despair. This is about when Dolly's in her teens. And what we can take from that moment, though, is that Philadelphia was a wonderful place for Dolly. It really suited her spirit, and it comes up again and again in the rest of her life, that it was an important time for her to be in this thriving, very metropolitan area. So because they were Quakers, when they first moved to Philadelphia, they entered into a fairly elite society. But with the downfall of Dolly's father, her mother ended up opening a boarding house to congressmen who were at the Capitol for the season. It was during this time that Dolly married John Todd, a Quaker lawyer, a fairly prosperous family in the area. She had two sons very quickly. And then during the 1793 yellow fever epidemic, both her baby and her husband died, and she lost both of her in-laws, many people in her family. It was an enormous plague in that neighborhood of Philadelphia, and was very dramatic. And we don't have a lot of letters during that time, but we have a few that note Dolly fighting for the settlement of her in-law's estate, seeking from her brother-in-law enough money to support herself. She went into debt burying her husband and baby, and it was a very trying time from what we gather. Of course, everyone would understand that situation. But very shortly afterward, young Dolly, she's about 25 and has a three-year-old, meets James Madison, who's a congressman in Philadelphia, through Aaron Burr, which is not what you'd expect, but he boarded at Dolly's mother's boarding house and had met Dolly and told James Madison about her and suggested they meet. And I believe they met in May and were married by August of 1794. very quick engagement. And they were actually married in near here, Harewood, just over the border in West Virginia, which was Dolly's sister's home. Dolly's sister, Lucy, had married George Washington's nephew, George Steptoe Washington, who in the period is fairly influential and ends up being important figure in Madison's life. So through this very quick relationship, Dolly marries a substantially older, 17-year-older bachelor. Madison was born quite near here, grew up most of his life at Montpelier. He was the son of a planter in the area, tobacco and wheat, typical of the time and the area. And he had been a politician for many years in first in New York, where the capital was, and then moved to Philadelphia. It was during her, well, when she married Madison, Dolly was unfortunately written out of the Society of Friends in Philadelphia. Madison was not a Quaker, and she married within a year of the death of her first husband, which I wrote her out of the faith. And it's that time when Dolly truly shifts her identity. But it's also when we start to know her. As a historian, it's an important time for me because we start getting correspondence, documentary materials that are extant. And so we understand Dolly differently during this time period. They live in Philadelphia for a few more years, and then when Adams is elected president, Madison retires from Congress to avoid the a political climate he doesn't favor, and they officially retire to Montpelier. So this is 1797, and as we all know, that is not what truly ends up happening, but at the time, they felt that they were coming back to Orange to live out the rest of their lives as planters in a rural elite community. And those of you who are coming next week, we'll talk a lot about this when we're in the house, but one of the most interesting things about Montpelier is that it actually was a duplex for many years. So when Dolly and James move back to Montpelier, it's a fairly traditional center hall colonial home with two rooms on either side of a passage, you know, very typical of the time period. But there are now two households living in this rather congested space. So Dolly and Madison build what we consider today to be a Philadelphia style townhouse attached to the north side of the house, which is a very odd architectural development. It's not something you see very often, certainly not in the period. And you actually had to go outside to get between the two households. Madison's parents are still there. His father died in 1801, but his mother lives till 1829, lives to be 98, and is very much an active part of her own household and the Madisons. But so during this period, our archaeologists on staff who are constantly digging in the grounds call this the retirement phase. The honeymoon phase for Dolly and James. And they find their wedding china in burrow pits, as archaeologists do, and they date things to honeymoon phase. I don't know that that's what we would call it, but the first few years of their marriage. They live in this interesting townhouse stuck to the side of the Montpelier plantation. And this is important for me as someone working in the curatorial department, trying to identify furnishings, because the house itself has a front and back parlor and then two bedrooms upstairs. And was really high style and high fashion in the time period. It was not rural. It was very much a metropolitan space. And it's during this time period that we start to learn more about their furnishing habits, which is what I think about on a typical day. That's where this research is headed for my group. But we see the Madisons purchasing goods from Europe during this time period through friends like the Monroes. James Monroe is in Europe during that time as, I believe he's master or minister plenipotentiary to France. And Madison writes that his new situation requires him to have some superior furnishings to the ones he had before. So Monroe sends him things like a large and a small secondhand rug, a Polonaise bed, which is something we are very excited about and interested. It's in the Polish style, the kinds of beds that have the draperies on top that are, have iron frames, supports. And all of these goods are purchased at the fire sales following the revolution, the French Revolution. And they get a great deal. You know, everything comes secondhand and inexpensively. And Madison even writes back to Monroe. He clips out some pieces of the fabric that were sent and says, "I think you got ripped off. This isn't silk. This is an inferior drapery. But because we got such a good deal anyway, we'll accept these pieces." So what we know during this period is that Dolly is changing how Madison thinks about his living environment. He would never, he, at least from what we understand of him today, would never have been interested in furnishings prior to this relationship with Dolly. He lived in boarding houses, and there's no mention of him acquiring possessions in this way. But it's also when we start to see their family growing through, they have Dolly's son, Payne Todd, and Dolly takes in her younger sister, Anna Payne Cutts, who's about 10 at the time. And the house seems large today as it's unfurnished, but you can imagine just how complicated it is with this growing family on in their side of the duplex, and then the large plantation family of the seniors, which includes some of Madison's siblings who are younger and have yet to marry and move out of the house. They live there ultimately only 3-4 years before Madison is called to Washington, the new capital, to serve as the Secretary of State for his good friend Thomas Jefferson, who's just been elected president. And Madison reluctantly left his private life to go back into politics. But from what we understand for Dolly, this was the best thing that could have happened. Got her back into more of a city environment and place where she could socialize and be influential in her own way. But of course, we all, I'm sure all of you know, Washington was just growing at that period. It was still partially a swamp. The roads weren't good. There were not a lot of shops. Most of the politicians didn't bring their wives with them because they were only there for short sessions of Congress. And so it was in that climate that Dolly first stepped in as the official hostess to the Jefferson administration. Jefferson at that time was widowed, and his daughters stayed at Monticello. Martha Jefferson Randolph stayed to run the Monticello estate. And Dolly was really the only permanent woman in a position to act as a hostess. And that's where we start to see the Dolly, who I think everyone is familiar with, this hostess, this friend, very gregarious and outgoing, personality. Jefferson's administration institutes their rule of pell-mell, the way in which Jefferson hosted dinners and negotiated with diplomats was to avoid conflict, to separate political foes. So he would have a dinner with the Federalists one night and the Republicans the next night, never inviting women typically, and just having these very egalitarian events, which turns out was quite democratic, but also didn't suit other heads of state who were visiting America. It was considered not only informal, but also at times rude. And there's this wonderful story, it's called the Mary Affair, we say now. Anthony married the, he was a British diplomat visiting Washington, came with his wife, and Jefferson had them over to dinner, and as they were being seated, Jefferson took the arm of Dolly and led her to the table because she was the person closest to him, and this was following his egalitarian, very democratic American style, but it outraged Mary. It was considered very rude to have not taken the arm of his wife, and it created a conflict in Washington, a very publicized, very gossip-heavy problem. And the Madisons had the Marys over soon afterwards and repeated the same treatment, where Madison took the arm of someone else, did not take Mrs. Mary's arm, and really he afterwards wrote many apology letters to his friends in England and said he was simply following the rule of the current administration and was deeply apologetic about the scandal it created. But that's really the moment I think that Dolly began to see herself in a diplomatic capacity and understand what she would do differently when she was First Lady. And she, as Madison was elected president, she very quickly took on a role as not just the official hostess, but really the face of welcoming democracy, not just simple egalitarianism. The night of the inauguration, Dolly hosted the first inaugural ball, invited all of Washington to come, and there were hundreds of people attended. And right away, in the first few weeks of the administration, instituted what she called drawing rooms, which were Wednesday evening events. It was basically an open house at the president's house, where anyone who had a question for the president, wanted to discuss anything political, could come to the White House. It would be very interesting to see that today. But this was something that prior administrations had done. The Adams had, the Washingtons would sit in the front of a room, and people could come in one at a time and discuss issues with them. But Dolly made a point to mingle with everyone who was there, and it really shook up the political climate. And she made a point to know everyone by name, introduce herself, learn why they were there, and in that way very much softened negative feelings towards the Madison administration, which was seen as simply a continuation of the Jefferson administration, which had its own political and economic problems. And very quickly was known as someone who was gregarious and charming, and she often, people write about her having a social disposition. And we know that that is a major part of President Madison's success. He was a, I know you've all learned about him through Dr. Stagg and know about him anyway from school. He was a bookish, very quiet, shy, reserved intellectual. And because of that, we have wonderful things like the Constitution and great political treatises, but he wasn't outgoing. And that was very much held against him as a congressman. And you can really see in his presidency how Dolly changes how people think about him. And she really buffers in between. There's a good quote I wanted to read to you. Anthony Morris, who is a Quaker, and one of the only Quakers who remained her friend throughout the rest of her life, wrote that she had the peculiar power she always possessed of making and preserving friends and of disarming enemies. And I think that's the best way to summarize her time as First Lady. But she also was in a unique position of patronage. And right off the bat, as soon as Madison was elected, we can see in the extant letters people writing to her from all across the country, but also all other parts of her own life, asking for favors, asking for political appointments, really reaching out to her specifically. And of course, you see that with Madison as well, but the ones to Dolly are asking her to intercede on behalf of the writers and their families. And they have a very interesting tone. And in some cases, Dolly did act and step in to get appointments for the children of friends or people she felt deserved a second chance. The other thing to talk about during the presidency, of course, affects my project that I'm working on, so it's of particular interest, but it also gets into the War of 1812, which we're just coming up on the bicentennial of, and it's on our minds at Montpelier. But the Jefferson administration, living in the president's house, was simply Jefferson and his secretary, who for most of his administration was Lewis of Lewis and Clark. So it was just two men, very few furnishings. Of course, they're in this dismal Washington climate. And it, unlike Monticello, which is one of the most interesting places to go visit with Jefferson's innovative furnishings and tools that you see throughout Monticello, in the president's house, he did very little to make it comfortable. So at the end of his administration, he petitioned Congress for funding to help the Madison administration make this a more welcoming place, because what Jefferson had learned was that it was both a public space where the citizens of the United States were welcome to be, but it was also a private residence, and it had to act in both capacities. So with the funding that Congress allocated, very quickly, Dolly stepped into a role decorating the house. And there are amazing records for this. All the funding came out of the miscellaneous treasury accounts, which still exist. I'm sure the Obama administration has their own miscellaneous treasury accounts. We'll see in a few years. But Dolly made a point that she would furnish the house completely with American-made domestic goods. And in that way, she sent a powerful message to America, of course, that she was committed to domestic manufacture of goods. But it also meant that we researchers at Montpelier, learn a lot about the crafts people, especially in Washington, but also in Baltimore and Philadelphia and New York in the time period. And for people who are furnishings aficionados, there are clues to early Washington society. Dolly worked with Henry Latrobe, who was an architect in the Capitol and very well known, but he acted as the commissioner of this project to furnish her house. And she started with the drawing room in anticipation of hosting these drawing room events, and then quickly moved to the dining room, these two public spaces. And the bedrooms and the rest of the house gets furnished much later. So it shows where she was putting her attention. But there are great records through the Latrobe correspondence where they design pieces, chairs with the Finley brothers in Baltimore, who were very significant in the time period. We hear about how the basic household was maintained, which is something we just don't have at Montpelier. So these are great clues for us to make sense of what their household was really like. The Martha Jefferson Randolph's household account book was just found a few months ago in a repository. And we're hoping there is a Dolly similar account book somewhere out there. And we know that they were common among women in the period, but unfortunately we have yet to find one. But these miscellaneous treasury accounts give us the best clue we have about seasonal household changes, things that we today take for granted in our own houses, changing out the rugs for winter, or when curtains were cleaned, just little things that would tell us something about the space. Now, this also gets us to the War of 1812. So I think everyone is aware of this story of the British invading Washington in 1814. They're slowly advancing on the city. And I think for many months, the citizens were assuming they would be attacked, but it just was so slow in happening that the city went on as usual for that summer of 1814. But in late August, Madison leaves Washington with the troops to strategize and stays in Maryland. But Dolly is still at the house collecting all the cabinet papers, which they were afraid would burn if the president's house was attacked. And there's the wonderful story of Dolly finally knowing she has to flee, that the British were very close, and she waits to take down the portrait of President Washington in the dining room. And part of that is probably apocryphal or overblown for sensation, but it also tells us something important about what she was valuing, that art was important to her, of course, that Washington was very important to her. And you can see that at Montpelier too. We know where the portraits of Washington were hung throughout the house. It's one of the few art records we have. But it's she writes in a letter to her sister writes to her and says, "I don't know where you are. I hope you're not at the president's house, because you're going to be caught in this skirmish." And in a subsequent note back, Dolly writes about our private property must be sacrificed in order to save the portrait of Washington. Just very moving. So the British do, in fact, burn the president's house. We all know that. And the White House is built out of that. But the Madisons never live in the modern White House today. Instead, they moved to the Octagon House in Washington, which was owned by the Talo family. I believe it's now a museum of architectural studies. And then they moved to what was called the Seven Buildings, which was the popular place to live in Washington in the period. But what's really important for us about that is, again, they're given funds by Congress to furnish the house because they lose all of their possessions in the fire. And so, again, we get some sense of what they are choosing to furnish the house with. And they also purchase back from the government some of the pieces that they buy for the seven buildings. And so we know they bring them back to Montpelier, which is just fascinating. And they mention makers and styles of pieces. It's a great clue for our presidential detective story. So soon after War of 1812 concludes, Madison retires from presidency in 1817, and they move back to Orange, where they are constantly visited. Just the list of visitors is astonishing, and we've made a lot of sense of visitors who stop at Montpelier and then go on to Monticello, or go from Natural Bridge to Monticello and then on to Orange on their way to Washington. So Dolly's life after 1817 is almost exclusively entertaining. And when you come to Montpelier, that's part of our message in the house, is talking about Dolly as a hostess. But in her letters, you start to see the strain of what that role is for her. There are some letters where she says she's sick of company, or she really hopes someone is delayed in visiting because it's getting to be pickling time, and she doesn't want to also be a hostess while she has to pickle the produce. And she writes, "I'm too busy a housekeeper to become a poet in my solitude." And it's just a very busy time period. What she hoped would be a retirement was actually one of the busiest times of her life. It's during that period that there's most of North America, an economic depression. The crops are not as successful as they had been. The market in Europe changes, and Madison is relying completely on the sale of wheat and tobacco to fund what has become an extravagant life, with all these visitors and high style, these French goods in the house. And the only way he sees that he can really make money is to edit and then sell his papers. And that seems like a very small, it doesn't seem like it would have such an impact on the story of Dolly's life, but it really ends up being what she spends 10 years of her life doing, acting as his secretary to edit these papers. And after he dies, she ultimately sells them to the Library of Congress because they are, it's wonderful that the Library, that Congress actually purchased these, but I think we read it today as sort of a move in pity, to give her some funds because otherwise she's desolate. And at this time also is when her son, Payne Todd, really becomes a burden on her and Madison. He is an alcoholic and a gambler and never really achieves a profession, doesn't marry. And we think that Madison paid as much as $40,000 to repay his debts. But in the 20s, he goes to debtor's prison, and it really breaks Dolly's heart. And you see it in the letters where she's writing to him, saying, "Please just let me know you're alive or you're okay." And this summer, we actually uncovered one of his diaries. We thought for a while that it was stained with ink, and so we couldn't read parts of it. But we found a new lighting technology to take digital photographs, and we could eliminate the splotches. And the diary is actually the same period of time while he's in debtor's prison. And you can trace her letters against what he's doing on any given day. And it's a very sad story, but it's also illuminating and interesting. It leads to Madison becoming interested in the temperance movement, which if you're watching Ken Burns' documentary, you're hearing all about. And you can see how it heightens her interest in selling the papers to Congress, Madison's correspondence and notes on the Constitution. And it really makes part of the end of her life tragic, because she's struggling for financial security. Madison dies in 1836, lived a very long life, dies at Montpelier, and pretty soon afterwards, Dolly's forced to sell the house. And there's a long, protracted legal battle, but eventually the silver lining to all of it is that she gets to move back to Washington, to a home they had bought for her sister, the young one who grew up in their household, Anna, Payne Cutts. And she moves right back into the social world of Washington. And she there are day books by other women who live in Washington during that period that we've been able to use to trace what parties Dolly is at. And there are years where she's almost every night of the week at some event in Washington. She ends up at the groundbreaking for the Washington Monument. She is one of the first people who poses for Matthew Brady's daguerreotype, early photography. So there's actually a photograph of Dolly, which is just remarkable. So I'll bring it for those of you who are going to be at, come visit us at Montpelier next week. But you just see her reintegrating into the social life that was so meaningful to her in Washington. Congress allows her to have a seat to watch the proceedings, and she really gets back into the life she cared so much about. And she dies in 1849 and is buried in the Congressional Cemetery. And then later they moved her back to Montpelier. So when you come visit, you can see the their gravestones. And it's a very interesting experience to see the whole family together. And one of my colleagues, who you may be familiar with, Tom Chapman, has done a large investigation of what that cemetery means and the continuation of Madison family members. But really what we're striving to do with the house is to bring back who Dolly was to what is an empty space, using the physical clues that we recovered from the architectural restoration, discovering where curtain pins were in the architraves of the windows, trying to make sense of the tacking marks on the floor to know what sorts of carpeting was in any given space, and really to bring back Dolly's sense of hospitality and abundance and social life, even in this, what she considered the wilderness out here, isolated. So I think take some questions if that's
for the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould.